Hi, welcome to Forensic Forecast. It's been a while since we last did an episode. I have been busy moving around and now based in Texas. So, having said that, what better time to have our first British guest on the show than after I've just moved out of the country. So, welcome, Gareth. How are you doing today?
Hi, Liam. Doing very well. How are you doing?
Not doing badly at all. Gareth, our special guest today, is going to be talking to us about some interesting things which I don't think many people in the forensics field really know about. So, Gareth, would you like to just introduce yourself, tell us who you are, where you're from, and that kind of thing?
Sure. My name is Gareth Davis. I work for the University of Glamorgan, which is a university in South Wales in the UK. At the university, I do research work into forensics, part-time lecturer. I actively do forensic consultancy, and through the forensic consultancy, I also do data recovery as well.
Awesome.
I'm associated to the Information Security Research Group at that university, which is headed up by Professor Andrew Blythe.
Fantastic. So, you talked a little bit, you said a little bit there that you do forensic consultancy, but you also are involved in data recovery side of things. That's the kind of thing which we want to focus our discussion on today. So, first of all, I mean, we've had Scott Moulton on the show previously, and he talked a little bit about data recovery and the like, and the impact of that on forensics, but you've given a couple of presentations recently that I think may have unnerved a couple of people and been quite surprising to them. So, I don't know. Do you want to just...
Yeah, sure. I guess I can elaborate on that a bit. I spoke at 44Con, which is a hacking conference in London recently, and I spoke about hard disk manipulation and... me being a researcher and a forensic investigator, putting that sort of cap on, I looked at how data recovery can be used for us to support the forensic investigation work. So when we have something in the lab that doesn't work, doesn't want to image, doesn't want to give us data back, how we go about getting the data off there, if that's still possible. Then looking at the tools themselves and wondering if these could be used against us potentially. So there might be a motivation for a forensic investigator to understand some of the processes and some of the techniques that are available through these new tools.
Awesome. So if we, in order to fully appreciate and understand what is we're going to be talking about, I think we probably need a bit of background really about the makeup of a hard drive. You know, a lot of people know, yeah, you got platters in there, typically, you know, and the various interfaces and stuff like that. But, I mean, there's obviously gaps in that knowledge that can be filled in by data recovery. So do you want to just give us a brief overview of how modern hard drives work?
Yeah, sure. Okay, well, modern hard drives themselves are, of course, man-made materials. They can be viewed as computer systems in their own right. They're complex devices made up of platters, as you said. We have read and write heads, which connect to voice coils, all the casing, the mountings, the PCB controller boards, all various mechanical parts inside, which are prone and due to failure. So this is where we incur them in data recovery. When things have gone wrong, things don't work and need to be rebuilt or replaced.
Okay. So, you talk about, like the, I guess, it's not really firmware, is it, that hard drives have? It's more a system.
It's a little bit of both. I like to describe it as, well, a hard disk, because it's just such a complex device, has its own internal disk operating system, I refer to it as, and that's known as the service area, where the drive is serving itself and making data available to you. Then we have firmware components within that service area, and they are, if you like, programs within. They have certain jobs, like to translate, for example, the physical location of a piece of data to a logical block address for the operating system to retrieve the data. That would be an example of a program inside the service area of the hard disk.
Right. So what kind of stuff do you usually find besides those special operating system type things inside a service area?
Well, the service area is part of the disk that the manufacturer uses to effectively operate the hard drive for the operating system, the higher level operating system, that is. You can have many different things inside the firmware area. We can have read-write head mapping, so we can talk about what read-write heads we have in use, what's turned off. We can look at the translator, I said, the physical to logical block translator. We have defect management systems. We have smart systems, which are self-monitoring and recording technologies. These basically keep an eye on the disk internally itself and look at predicting failure. So that's something we can talk about more in a forensic light maybe later. There are different areas within the service area. We have things like the host protected area, the device configuration overlay. And these are all sections that the manufacturer would use and tweak to produce a hard disk drive for an intended market.
You mentioned about HPA and DCL there. Now, those, I think most forensics people understand and know what those are. But, I mean, one of the things which we talk about in forensics here and there and things which come up whenever you're doing, you know, acquisitions of hard drives is whether you actually acquired the whole drive. So, you know, some tools will take DCO and HPA drives and acquire the whole thing. Some won't. So, you know, investigators have to take certain steps in order to ensure that they've captured, you know, all of the evidence. But from the presentation which you gave at 44Con, this sounds like this isn't the only way that somebody could potentially maliciously hide data from a forensic investigator.
No, I think you're correct. There are other areas that we can use to store data in that perhaps a lot of these imaging tools are not querying and looking for data in. So therefore, the impact of forensics is if I don't image a disk physically, physical addresses that perhaps an LBA isn't attached to, then am I getting absolutely everything back? And of course, if I'm not, then that impacts upon potential evidence not being in our image files.
One of the things I learned when I was at Disk Labs quite early on was that you can't always believe what you see in terms of hard drives. One of the things which I was shown very early on was, you know, bring a hard drive in and we'll change some of the things on it. We'll change some of the data in the system area.
Mm-hmm.
To reflect, to show that, you know, that this, or to show that this drive was not what the label says it is. So you could have your own brand hard drive. You could change the LBA on the hard drive. You know, you could change any of that, at all. And I don't know. How difficult is it to actually go in and to do that kind of thing?
Well, if you want to talk about changing bits of the hard drive, I guess an example would be an easy way to talk about what the tools can do and how it impacts upon forensics. So if we went in and started to remap things, this can be for good and bad reasons. An instance of it being a positive change would be for working with embedded devices. I work with CCTV devices quite often. And occasionally, we need to take the original source drive, copy it to a clone drive for the DR. And then if we need to work with the bespoke operating system and the firmware for that CCTV drive, sometimes there's relationship management issues between the new clone created from the failing disk. When we put that clone into the original CCTV device, it's looking for another disk. So it's looking for perhaps a firmware ID or a serial number. When it queries the disk inside it, although the data is good, the serial number and the firmware won't match. Therefore, the disk will reject it. So that's an instance of a positive change. A negative change could be we could use the service area to corrupt the translator that I've spoken about previously, the physical, the logical address translator. And by corrupting that, we physically put the data beyond retrieval. Every time we would try and image the disk, every sector would be an error. Therefore, we wouldn't be having access to what's on the platter because the hard drive itself would not know the channel to go through to get the requested LPA. It wouldn't have its map. So that would be a negative example of a firmware or a service area change.
Essentially, if I understand what you're saying here, what you can do is that you can take a hard drive, and if you have the specialist knowledge required, you know, you can have a hard drive which has a capacity of, say, a terabyte, yep. But then you can then go in, you can edit the details of that hard drive on the service area to say that it is only, say, for example, a 500 gigabyte hard drive.
Yeah, sure. If you think about these are all man-made products, when they go through the assembly line, they don't all come out and meet their criteria. Say if we were trying to make a terabyte disk, we put 10 through assembly line because we have physical defects on things like the platters because we can never make them perfect. There are predicted failures. So manufacturers use these service areas to turn off various bits and pieces within the hard disk. And as you say, you could have a disk that was intended to be a terabyte. Actually, it comes out to around 800 gigabytes, the manufacturer would use a service area to turn off perhaps some of the read-write heads on the platters that were defective, then maybe manipulate the disk further with a DCO configuration to make the disk perhaps 750 gigabytes, which is a typical size we can find on the market. It's all about sort of capping the drives when they are slightly defective. We have physical problems on some of the platters to still make them saleable to us, the consumers. So these types of things can be configured for various reasons. And then, of course, if we are hiding information on the disk, if we turn it off, read-write heads, for example, when we're taking out 200 gigabytes of the drive's actual native capacity, then, of course, that's something we should be aware of in forensics, I think.
How difficult is it to do that in order to change the, you know, I realize that each drive and each manufacturer is different.
Yes, they are.
But I mean, if you just took, just say, you know, the standard Western Digital hard drive, how easy is that to go in and to change that kind of data on that drive?
With a basic understanding of hard disk architecture, the way the service area works and how firmware plays a role, with access to the right tools and that knowledge, it's not extremely difficult. It's not something that maybe Joe Public could do with access to just the tools, but with the right amount of research and funding, then yes, I think it's very possible that people could learn how to do this effectively in a short period of time and sort of manipulate the disks to show perhaps less than what's actually on there.
Yeah. One of the things which, going back to my time at Disk Labs, I had a drive which I brought in, and using some of this specialist software, one of the data recovery engineers took this 300 gigabyte hard drive and essentially clipped it to 250 gigs. So the thing, this hard drive sat in my drawer for months on end. And every time I thought about it, I thought, this is potentially really quite terrible.
Quite a game changer,
yeah,
yes.
Because, I mean, whereas, you know, like I said before, the forensic tools, or some of the forensic tools will pick up DCO and HPA areas on the hard drive, nothing that I tried, whether it was hardware, software, anything, none of that would see the full 300 gig on that hard drive. They all reported that the hard drive only had 250 gig storage on it. So,
because that's what the hard drive has in its own sort of operations, and so that's what it queries and gives back to you, the user. So, yeah, it's it's quite important that we try and understand how we can find out the native sizes of these drives, and we don't have a lot of opportunity apart from the disk label sometimes, and of course that can be replaced as well.
Absolutely. So besides looking at the disk label, and besides memorizing the exact shape and size of every single hard drive on the market,
yeah, sure.
What ways are there currently to determine what the original hard drive size was?
That's a good question. I believe there's a lot of DR people out there I know that will be able to open up a disk minus the label and have a good stab at exactly how large the drive is. But of course, we don't all have that knowledge, and especially forensics, that's not our job. That's not our day-to-day, so we can't be expected to know that. The tools are available to query the firmware, and I'd suggest that one of the first things I would look at would be the defect management area of the hard disk, looking at how many physical defects have been added into it. So for a bit of background, every hard disk, as we mentioned, it's typically clipped slightly at manufacture to get it down to a standard size. As the disk, that's called a P-list. That's worth mentioning, a production list of defects. So the drive has a P-list. Then when we take it and we plug it in and we format it and install our operating system, we always notice it's slightly less than we paid our money for. It's always slightly less than a terabyte.
Yes.
Because, of course, the service area needs space to live, as do the firmware modules. So we have that P-list. The first thing I would look at for a forensic investigator would be looking at the contents of the growth list. The growth list is the list of defects that actually occur as the disk lives in our hardware, and naturally incurs physical defects as it ages. So it would take that physical defect and add it into the G-list. And what it would do, it would transparently behind the user operating system, take the data from the physical defect that has occurred, place the data in a reserved area, and reassign the LBA to that new physical location. So we wouldn't see a difference as a user. So we could use that maliciously as well to map out data into large sections. There's also a growth list from a G list in some drives, which goes to a track list. So we can mark whole tracks as defective, and those track lists can be quite substantial on some drives if manipulated in the right way. So number one, I would look at the defect management system. Number two, I would look at the heads map on a drive, because we have multiple read-write heads, and it's possible to turn off a couple of read-write heads, which essentially cancels out one of the platters inside the hard disk. So that would be number two. I would look at, are all the heads working? Are they not? There will be occasions when you'll have heads turned off natively from the factory. Again, problems with that part of the platter the head would be responsible for reading. But it might be still possible to get our forensic image pre-reconfiguration with the firmware tools, and then look at what might be possible going forward, and maybe looking at how we can investigate the growth list's contents, the T-list contents, and have a look at maybe testing whether some of the heads that are turned off are actually operational, and make a decision on whether or not it would be an idea to look at those areas which have been turned off, essentially.
Wow. Essentially, we've gone from quite a simple process of, you know, taking out a hard drive, connecting it to a write blocker, getting the full forensic image, to now quite an extensive and complicated, well, to us, sounds like quite a complicated process of getting a full image from the drive.
I'd say it's probably harder for us, the forensic investigator, yes, to query the drives than it is for perhaps Joe Public, with the right time, the right resources, and the right inclination to use some of the DR tools against us potentially. And of course, we have to keep our forensic hat on, recognize the APRIL guidelines, and we're always going to be working with the original at this point as well, which is worth mentioning. And we need to be extremely careful, and we handle original evidence items, because typically we know we take our forensic image of the original, verify it, and never work with the original again. Always work with our copies, remaining forensic integrity in the investigation. So we have issues and challenges right there straight away off the bat, because we are changing things potentially on the original drive. Although it's outside of the user area and we're not affecting user data by querying the service area and the firmware modules, it's still something that we need to be careful and mindful of.
Absolutely. Which brings up another interesting point, I suppose, is that, you know, whenever we do take forensic images of hard drives, you know, many, many times I've seen people say that this is an exact copy of everything contained on the hard drive. Now, from what I understand, and from what I've seen in my own experience, this isn't necessarily true, is it? Because whenever we're even just plugging a hard drive in to power it up in order to acquire it, you can actually theoretically, well, you are changing data on that drive without knowing it.
Yeah, we need to be careful with distinctions like this. We need to sort of say we're not changing the user area. We're not accessing the user area. We're dealing with a different section of the disk, and we don't step outside of that boundary. So no, you rightly say in that context with working with the service area that the service area is reading and writing to itself typically on the disk starting up, because it's checking various parameters, it's doing self checks and all various things like that, updating smart information as well. So things are being updated, but we need to be clear that it's not in the user area, it's outside, it's in the firmware, etc.
Okay.
But no, a statement like that, as you say, an exact bit for bit copy is sometimes can be a bone of contention if you really want to push the technology and talk about accessing all areas of data. But we as forensic investigators are, of course, interested with the user data area, because 9 out of 10 people, of course, they don't understand hard drive technology and they never step outside of the user area, which is a good thing for us, I guess.
Have you ever seen anything like that in the wild, so to speak?
I've seen it with NAND devices recently in the last few months. I've never had a job come into the lab where I think it's been remapped using firmware tools. I am mindful of it, and I do look at things like HPAs and DCOs. I do a lot of forensic data recovery work as well for various clients. And in those instances, I will be working with the service area to get the disk up and running. But of course, everything's noted and auditable to sort of be looked at by a third party, so it can be understand what's happened to the disk. But I know I've never seen a disk manipulated in the wild, to be honest, for platter-based technology. NAND-based technology, yes, I have.
Okay. One of the things which I've thought about this particular topic before is that you say that, you know, Joe Public probably doesn't have the resources or the knowledge to do this. And I can't imagine that, you know, that the average criminal sitting at home who wants to hide his information would go to such extreme lengths in order to hide it in the event that he gets caught. But, maybe
it's always possible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I started working with these data recovery tools basically because I was having cases in and the disk was physically defective or logically defective. It had problems with its disk operating system, the service area. So I had to investigate why this was happening and how recovery was possible, if possible. So this is how I got into the DR side of things when I stepped outside of forensics, because I couldn't do my forensic job and I had to. It was important that I did. So I had to get the disk up and running and access the data. So that's how I made my crossover. Now, initially, when I started to look around the industry, it was very difficult to get any credible information, any real information, because it's such a lucrative industry.
Yes.
And of course, there's always a need for DR, because that's what we use to store our data. We use digital devices and we need data recovery when things go bad. But because it is a lucrative business and a good one, there's not a lot of widely available information for free out there. There are products, there are various forums, but they don't really teach you about the engineering sort of side of data recovery, which is an engineering process. I'd say it's not an automated sort of push button process. It can be many various stages to get a disk back up and running from physical reconstruction to logical reconstruction. But recently I've seen some of these tools that were very expensive come down in price. And I've also seen new tools on the market come out that are quite obtainable for Joe Public to go out and buy now. They are hundreds of pounds instead of thousands of pounds and tens of thousands of pounds. So there may be more opportunity now for people to obtain these devices and start to play with them and start to see what they're capable of out there.
So if we're up to play devil's advocate for a moment, or we both were, let's say that you had some data on a drive that you wanted to conceal or otherwise hide from somebody. What would you do in that circumstance?
If I put that hat on, I'd probably look at manipulating things like defect areas because they're natural occurrences and they're hard to verify. There's no list. They're usually unique on every drive. Therefore, it would be difficult to assess the legitimacy of them. I make sure in my presentations that I show perhaps what could be possible using easily obtainable tools now after, you know, the price drop and things. But I also talk about the forensic methodology. How can we test for this? How can we educate ourselves to this? How can we do our forensic investigation in the sense of we can look at getting all the data back from the defect areas that is possible? So it's worth saying that there's a positive and a negative side to this sort of information being out there. It's educational awareness for investigators and what opportunities they have to look and query the disk further, and how we can do our jobs. Then we also need to be aware of that bad guys typically are ahead of us in technology terms. There's been many sort of case studies that you could example and reference, but usually we are playing catch up, and I think we need to look at anti-forensic techniques and take them seriously, because I know there are always going to be people looking for the right way to do the wrong things.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you talked a little bit about NAND. We'll get on to that in just a minute.
Sure.
But we also touched on smart data.
Yes.
Now, this, whereas, you know, the stuff which we talked about up to now is quite specialist and would require, you know, really quite, like you said, specialist tools, perhaps training in order to get that information. Mm-hmm. Smart data, whereas not quite as comprehensive, still holds some interesting stuff in it, and we can access that quite easily, can't we, as forensics people?
Yes, you can.
So what kind of stuff would you find in the smart data for a hard drive, then, that would be useful?
Smart data, so that's self-monitoring and recording technologies. That's the drives themselves, looking at how they're operating, how they're doing their job, and ultimately try and predict their own failure. Because, of course, we have things like average sector reads. The manufacturer dictates how long the read-write head should take to get that data back, process out through the PCB board, through the interface to the PC, to the higher-level OS. So when things like reads take longer on certain sections of the drive, that's updated in the smart data, and we look at error rates and things. But I would say most importantly in the smart data for me would be sort of disk power up time and things like that. And we can see how many times it's been powered on, powered off, how long it's been alive, or et cetera. I remember a case that I heard about talking with a colleague, and it was a company who came in and servers were not working that morning, and it looked like potentially they'd been overwritten by an upset employee that had left the company. But on checking the smart, you could actually see that the disks were brand new and they hadn't been overwritten. And so the original disks had been removed from the server and new disks put in. So that would be one example of smart being helpful in forensics. We knew we weren't looking at the right disks in question.
Awesome. Yeah, that's, I've had that that exact same thing happened in one of the cases I worked on.
Yeah.
It was bizarre because, you know, the looking at the actual data on the drive, all zeroed out, you could easily have sat there and said, yep, this has been wiped. No question.
Mm-hmm.
But having simply just someone having exchanged the disks was, I mean, in your mind, is there any other way of knowing that would have been the case other than checking the smart data?
I guess you could talk about internal audit logs for Kit and look at what the configurations were previously in the servers. Maybe having a look at the servers sat alongside them, usually bought in batches. Having a look at the dates even on the manufacturing labels for the disks themselves and knowing how long the servers have been up and running. But if things like that aren't available, then you come back to looking at the disk's internal analysis recording functions and seeing what's there and what it can tell you. And maybe it's helpful, maybe it's not. Smart data can be helpful to the forensic investigator, but it's not always quantifiable because all the manufacturers use sort of different ways of smart implementations. All the figures mean different things. So you're going to have 1 to 10, 10 being the top end of the scale, 1 being the bottom end of the scale in one drive, and you can have the reverse in another. And it can be 1 to 100 as well. So sometimes it's difficult to quantify exactly what the measurements mean, but with things like running time, it's quite intuitive for us to see those.
Absolutely. Would you recommend checking these things as a matter of course, or are they more for special cases?
I think extra information is always a plus. And to check the smart, it's not difficult with the right tools. It's fast. And it could provide something. Do I think it's necessary in every investigation? No. I think it's something to be mindful of. And it wouldn't take a great deal of time or effort to get that data if it was required. So I think it's worth knowing about.
Fair enough. Well, thank you very much for that. So moving on to NAND technology now. So now specifically we're going to be talking about solid state drives. You've recently done some research into those and seen, as you said, seen in the wild, some interesting things being done with these drives in order to manipulate data or potentially hide things. Is that correct?
Yes. We've looked at them as a research group, and we've had some great students, Emily Beeney, look at NAND technology and forensic best practice and things, and we found some very interesting results. Results I communicated at the first Forensic Forum conference back in November, earlier this month. The presentation was sort of focused around NAND memory forensics and the issues and challenges we look at as forensic investigators. Because again, these tools are mass produced. The technology is mass produced, and there are tools out there for configuration. So with my DR sort of hat on and knowing what's possible with platter-based technologies, NAND was identified to be sort of researched into to see if the same sorts of techniques for data manipulation, digital steganography, could be mapped across into NAND technology. And there are occasions where, yes, NAND controllers can be manipulated and data can be hidden and devices can be reprogrammed to mimic other devices possibly as well.
Obviously, the build-up, the creation of SSD drives is completely different, you know, to the platter-based ones.
Yes.
I think probably the only thing that they have in common, the interfaces that the computer reads from. So, what consists of an SSD, a modern SSD hard drive?
Well, SSDs are basically chip technology. So we have NAND chips. We have large banks of these NAND chips. They're electronically programmable transistors, essentially, and they store a charge, a 0 or a 1, which differs from a hard disk because we have typically 3D wave magnetic platter signs on the disk that indicate a 0 or 1. So we have a transistor and a stored charge as opposed to a wave sign on a platter. The The interface is the same, you say, so you'd have your SATA interfaces, but the structure is very different internally. So we have the physical chips, as I've said, and then their structure in the way they store data. If you talk about there's different types of chips, there's single level cells, there's multi-level cells. And the way the data is organized is different from a hard disk where we have sort of perpendicular recording and we have some of the head sector addressing systems. Here we're talking about pages, planes, and blocks and how they're mapped together to create sort of storage capacity. So it is quite radically different internally, both physically and logically, how data is stored compared to platter-based technology.
Wow. So one of the things which I've noticed when I had an SSD hard drive in my computer workstation at my previous job, whenever you plugged it in, it said that it was a RAID. So
okay,
is that something which is quite common? Do computers treat SSDs typically as RAIDs? I mean, it's my understanding that like the controller card that sits on an SSD drive that provides access to the chips is not too dissimilar to a RAID controller. Is that accurate, or
that's a nice? Off? I'd say that's a nice way of giving a sort of high level explanation, because we have, if you imagine, all these blocks, huge blocks, made up of many, many pages. The blocks and the pages interleave as well. And if we talk about wear leveling in NAND technology, because wear leveling exists, background wear leveling is where data is mapped around all the physical cells in the disk. And what happens is, whereas we would write with a hard disk and it would pretty much be sequential on the space on the platter that we have to write the data to. On an SSD, we can write one file and it will get sort of chopped up into many bits and put into many different locations. And that happens due to wear leveling. And wear leveling is there to keep the SSD effectively operating as long as it can. So it makes the chip usage as even as possible, because depending on the type of chip, we only have so many read and write cycles before that chip essentially dies. So it tries to distribute the workload over all the chips to, for endurance purposes, to keep the SSD alive for as long as possible with its maximum capacity.
All right. So that kind of brings some interesting challenges, I suppose, to doing SSD data recovery, because if you have a failed controller, I imagine it's going to be very, very difficult to get all the data back off those chips in any kind of readable format.
It is difficult, but the technology is there. There's three sort of highly polished solutions out at the moment. And basically, if the controller fails and the SSD or the interface breaks down, then it would be our job to extract all the NAND chips inside the device in a sequence and image those chips individually and then rebuild the file system using these specialist DR tools that would essentially emulate the controller chip and provide access to tangible files.
Very nice. It's all quite magical, I think.
It's certainly don't really understand awesome it. Technology, to be fair.
Okay, so moving on to potentially malicious uses of this, and you said you'd seen some things happen in drives that you've seen yourself where someone's actually manipulated these. Can you go into a bit more detail about that?
Yeah, sure. I guess what I've incurred personally coming into my lab is data recovery jobs, because people have bought sort of cheap and cheerful USB sticks, and they've come from various online suppliers or countries, and you pay for a 500 gigabyte stick. Actually, you're getting much less than that, but the device controller thinks that it has a 500 gigabyte file size. So in the interest of DR, when we're trying to fill up our 500 gigabyte USB, what's actually happened is we're hitting our upper limit, and then when we add more data to the modified NAND, device. Essentially, we corrupt the file system because we start physically rewriting back to the beginning of the NAND chip, because it's like a round robin system, if you want to say that, on NAND chip. So we physically corrupt the file allocation tables and the operating systems we use for storage on those devices. The files aren't retrievable. The disk, the device wants to be formatted. And that's when we see them in for data recovery. So they're manipulated to be sold at a higher price, and they provide a lower storage capacity than is advertised. There's many examples of this sort of manipulation out there. There's the simple ones like that, where essentially the device corrupts after the native size is surpassed. Then there are also, I've seen examples, and I've shown them in my slides at various presentations, where there's been a more complex manipulation where the NAND stick is sort of what it looks like is buried inside a USB 2 hard drive. Again, let's use the 500 gig sort of scenario. You're actually not reaching that capacity, but instead of a corruption, the file actually, the NAND device itself reuses the available storage capacity over and over again. So an example would be, let's say this device is 10 gig, nice and easy. We have five files on there, a gig each. So essentially we have 5 gig of space left.
Yep.
We expect that we can write an extra 20 gig to it. So if we wanted to upload a movie with storage, we could put that onto that space. Problem being with this manipulation, it reuses the physical address system that it has left, and it continually overwrites the video file with the video file. So if you finish the write, it would complete successfully. You take that, plug it in another day, access the five original files, they would work, no problem. When you went to watch a movie, you'd perhaps have the last third of the movie, and you'd be scratching your head wondering why. And simply because the previous two-thirds of the movie have actually been overwritten with the last third, because that's all the physical space that was actually left on the NAND device. But of course, it tries to communicate it has more space than that, which is why you put that larger file on the device.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple. I know of a couple of examples of that. My brother bought an MP3 player off eBay, and it said it was like 30 gigabytes or something on there, when in reality it only had like 10 in total. So he wasn't pleased about that. But anyway, yeah. And then there was another more publicized one that I think a few people probably already heard of, where somebody bought a hard drive from someone in a car park or parking lot somewhere, and when they plugged in the hard drive, it said that, you know, they had. So this is an external USB drive, I think. When they plugged it in, it said that they had something like 500 gigabytes, but then the drive kept failing. And when it was opened up, inside was just a small 512 megabyte USB stick and a couple of lead weights.
That's exactly the sort of pictures I've shown in the presentations, because it is quite a public one. And it's sort of, I pose the question, is this our friend or our enemy? And I show the disc on the slide, and I ask for everybody's sort of input on it. Is it a USB? Is it a platter? Look at the size. How big do you think it is? Do we actually know these devices? And then, of course, the next slide shows the USB stick, as you say, inside instead of the platter-based technology that we would expect to find. And a couple of lead weights just to add fuel to the fire, really. Make the device weigh as much as it should, because a lot of people still sort of, it feels heavy, it was worth the money. It's got to be heavy if it's expensive. And I'm not sure why nobody's ever queried why the drive doesn't actually spin or vibrate at all.
Yeah. Key things that you should probably look for.
I'd expect it to vibrate or spin slightly on the table and be noticeable.
Yeah.
But it's a classic example of the way people are manipulating these devices and then selling them for much more than their retail value on the market. And I guess it poses problems for us for forensics as well, because if these devices are used and form part of an investigation and of course they are corrupted through normal use, then we have problems, don't we? And we need to be able to still recover the data on them so we can incur these in the wild, as we put it.
Well, I hadn't thought about that particular eventuality before. That's really interesting.
I mean, with people sort of jailbreaking iPads, iPhones, and, you know, you can do the same on Android devices. You can root them as well and run various softwares that perhaps weren't intended. You can also potentially corrupt, you know, the file system on an iPad. And then when we're trying to dump the user data, maybe we've corrupted the device so much that that's not possible. So we have to go to a chip off scenario. So there is potential for these modifications to occur. And, you know, it can just give us extra bumps in the road in the forensic investigation, if you will.
So I imagine that if you can manipulate an SSD, if we manipulate a NAND device to show that it has a lot more capacity than it has, then I'm assuming we can do the same thing that we can do with the platter-based drives, and that is
to cap them,
make it look like, yeah, exactly.
So we've got the overclock capacity function, which gets into file system corruptions, makes our analysis more difficult. But then, of course, as you rightly say, we have the other end of the scale, where we can manipulate downwards, so we can hide data again, digital steganography in the NAND chips themselves, and make things smaller than they should. They should be natively. I mean, it's the same with the platter-based technology. Sometimes not all the cells, all the pages, all the blocks are operational. So the manufacturer can use various manufacturing production tools to cap the device as well. So there are, if you like, the same sort of approach to the defect management systems in a hard disk drive with platters as there is with NAND devices as well. They can be used for as production aids when overclocking or underclocking. If we can underclock it, then yeah, that manipulation is possible, and we can hide data from the native FTL translator, the firmware translation layer. So they won't be seen by our imaging tools again, because our imaging tools assume the controller firmware hasn't been modified and is truthfully given us access to all the physical spaces that it has. So the translator is trusted and all the LBA data associated is copied. Forensic impact for us, if we've downgraded the device and hidden data into those physical spaces which aren't addressed by LBAs anymore, then the impact to forensics is we've missed data or we haven't got everything that we should have.
It's absolutely riveting, all this. I've wanted to talk about this on the podcast for so long, but never really had that much of an opportunity to. I find it fascinating that, you've not really seen it happen to date, but the potential is there for it to happen.
Sure.
And the potential that people have missed things in the past. You know, like I was saying, is that, you know, the average person before probably didn't have the funds or the resources to do this, but on large scale investigations, you know, for large scale fraud or maybe for terrorism or something like that, I mean, there's potential that stuff has been missed in that regard, because they're very well funded and very
I'd say that the platter based technology, the tools there are they are very expensive. We have some cheap alternatives, which are a few hundred pounds, are the tools I've spoke of that potentially Joe Public can go out and buy on the internet today for low cost. I think it's more problematic in the NAND space, because some of these mass production tools that you can use to remap the NAND devices themselves are free. They're just online. If you know where to go, you can pick up the manufacturing production tools. They're not heavily documented, and there has to be a level of knowledge to associate the right controller chips and the right NAND chips themselves to a particular tool. So there's a lot of research to be done in that space to identify the right mass production tool to reconfigure your USB stick. But when you can make that association, if the tool's out there, and I know a lot of them are, then it's a free download off the internet, and you can start playing and potentially altering these devices if you know what you're doing and you have access to the right tool.
Oh, that is scary.
So there's not a higher associated cost as well with this, with NAND devices, which I think is definitely of note, basically. And that's what I was highlighting at the F3 conference, that these manipulations are possible and they're almost more obtainable because of the lower costs.
Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about specifically, anything important that you think we haven't yet touched on?
I guess it's worth saying as well, with these modification tools for the NAND, we can not only sort of hide data beyond forensic retrieval with our traditional tool sets, so the software imaging tools I'm talking about, but we can also reprogram them in other ways as well. So we can manipulate how operating system views the actual disk, the NAND device. So I think that feeds into USB trace identification. So I'm talking about the registries and things like that in operating systems. So if we can manipulate the NAND device to impersonate a scanner, a printer, we can use it with the operating system, and we don't have the same association as we would do with a storage device that we may then go and look for. So we could possibly rename it to something quite innocent, if you like. And then we can also use the same tools to reprogram it to impersonate something. So there is the potential to impersonate somebody else's USB key. And of course, that's problematic in itself, but that can also bypass security mechanisms and things where we have trusted devices in some secure locations. So if we can impersonate other devices, then we can maybe subvert security mechanisms and cause problems.
Good grief. So, you know, all the usual places where you would look in the registry for a USB drive would just all of a sudden become quite redundant if you found, you know, if this device had been programmed to be a scanner or a printer or, you know, something else.
There is our opportunity because we can alter things like the vendor name, the product name, VID and PID, vendor and product identifications, manufacturer, serial number, the label. We can constantly make these devices lie to the high-level operating system. So it would be hard to spot in those instances.
Wow. That is very, very interesting. And scary, might I add. But
it is of concern, which is why I was happy to sort of deliver it at F3 and just sort of get everybody on the same page, so we know that if we come across some interesting tools like these on systems we're investigating, that, you know, we need to be careful then of what else is associated with the investigation, and just be mindful that if these tools are in some of the data sets we're analyzing, that we need to know what their capabilities are potentially and keep that in mind.
Well, I think that's got to be the case for anything that we touch in forensics, really, is that even if we don't have a full, complete working knowledge of how hard drives or any other hardware, for that matter, functions, we at least need to know some of the basics. And we need to be aware of issues like this so that we can compensate for them in our investigations. So,
yeah, I think, you know, when I do the presentations, it's more situational awareness. Hey, guys, this is what's out there. This is what I know to be true. Please just sort of remember this. And if you ever want to send an email or a query, please do. You know, I'm always here to help. But I'm just trying to do my bit for the community and just sort of create some education and awareness and just try and work together to help all of us. I mean, we can't know everything as just one person, which is why we work in some great teams. But there's still so much that changes and so much we need to update. And I think things like this podcast are a brilliant way to do it, because we all have access to the internet typically, and we can all download this podcast and listen to it and sort of gain new information that perhaps we would have spent time digging for before. I think this is a really good resource for those purposes.
Thanks very much. All right. Well, thanks for coming on today. Really, really appreciate it. And thanks for sharing all that information. You're welcome. I'm sure people are going to find this absolutely fascinating and valuable, and you know, and also quite scary, as I have. Thank you very much for that. Where can people find you online anywhere if they want to reach out to you?
I don't have any Facebooks or Twitters or any LinkedIn profile, so I guess email would be the best way. So my university email address would be gddavies@glam.ac.uk if people would like to get in touch. I know you have my email as well, Lee, obviously, so if they want to get in touch with you, if that's easier, and then you could pass them on to me, that's fine. I'm happy to answer any questions that people have on this type of stuff. I'm happy to share and I'm happy to help.
I just want to, on behalf of everyone who's going to listen to this, thank you very much for being on and sharing the information. It really has been extremely interesting.
I hope it's been helpful.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, if anything else crops up in the future, we'd love to have you back on to talk about any further developments.
Sure, we're always very active in research, and we've got three papers, academic papers, coming out talking about the various NAND technology and devices and the possible manipulations and the data recovery case studies and scenarios. So I guess I'll keep you posted, and if I can ever be of service again, just let me know. Happy to help.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Very welcome, Lee.
Okay, so that was Gareth Davies of the University of Glamorgan in Wales. Pleasure to have him on, and I'm sure he'll be back in the future. Also, just want to say that now that we're settled in Texas, I plan on doing Forensic Forecast episodes a bit more frequently, hopefully get it down to like a 2-week cycle or something like that, or maybe twice a month or something. And yeah, we'll see how that works out. So if you have anything interesting to share with the forensic community, any research you've done, anything you've discovered recently, it would be fantastic to hear from you. And we'll see if you would like to discuss your findings on Forensic Forecast. Just to let everyone know where I am in Texas, I've joined a company called Digital Discovery. They're in the Dallas area. And I've joined them as the Director of Forensics there and enjoying it so far. So hopefully this is the start of a long, successful career here in the States. One other thing as well is that I've started a Forensic Forecast shop where you can buy T-shirts with some interesting and, I like to think, amusing little slogans on the front. So you can find that at forecast.spreadshirt.com. You can also do the short link for f4c.me/shop. And I'll get you there as well. So thanks for listening again this time around, and guarantee it won't be that long until the next episode. Bye for now.